Discussions with Ajahn Suchen in Bangkok, June 1995. Recorded and edited by Jonathan and Sarah. Speakers include Jonathan, Sarah, Gabriella, Ivan, and Al.
Does one want to become detached?
Detached from what?
From everything in life. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, thinking.
Does one want to?
Only in theory.
Only in theory,
not
right.
Not in practice. In practice, do we really want to
give up? So one can see that when it's not panya or right understanding, it's impossible to try to have the idea of wanting to become detached from all these things. Because while one is speaking like that, there is attachment too.
Even wanting to be detached.
Mm-hmm. There is attachment for sure.
What sort of attachment would there
attached
be in
to such
idea.
Thinking idea, yeah.
Or attached to the idea of how one would be as a person with no attachment and that sort of thing.
Because it's not right understanding yet.
I suppose there could be some wholesomeness in it if one understands at a theoretical level the disadvantages of attachment. There could be some wholesomeness in the realization that it's better to be without attachment.
But the best thing is just understanding reality as it is. Don't dream or want to not having this or having that, but just understand reality as it is. Whether it's attachment or aversion, it's there, it's real, it's conditioned, it appears.
Yes, that's interesting. What that statement does, it highlights the fact that we probably think more about being a person with no attachment or a person with less attachment than actually understanding moments of reality. But I suppose the desire for less attachment can be a condition to study the realities.
Because
the
one can see that one cannot become detached just by thinking or wanting. So one learns more to understand reality which appears.
You could also say, for that matter, that then the studying of moments of reality is likewise prompted by a misunderstanding. If one thinks, I would like to have less attachment,
that's not right.
What I need to do is study moments of reality, therefore what I'll do is study moments of reality. It doesn't seem to me there's any more understanding in that than
it's only desire or attachment.
Right.
No wrong view, no misunderstanding. But one can see that how much there is attachment in a day. Almost every minute.
Not when there's dosa, not when there's anger,
right,
irritation.
Right, or vibhaga, or seeing, hearing.
Well, what I'm saying is one can have actually a lot of dosa in a day.
A lot?
Yeah.
Not more than lobha. Never more than lobha.
No, this is something that you've mentioned before. Another way of saying it is that it's actually quite difficult to see how much attachment one has in a day, because when there's dosa, one has no idea of the attachment that's there as well. You know,
because it's there all the time, so one cannot see it. It
becomes the norm.
Yes,
or aversion.
Aversion.
Any shade of
any from small annoyance
irritation.
Or not liking to stream.
And lobha
is attachment.
Is attachment, okay.
So three groups of compulsiveness, lobha, attachment, dosa, aversion, and lobha, ignorance.
But wouldn't, so the only way, the proper way to become detached from things, we cannot desire it, so we have to go through the process of eliminating our ignorance. And
By having more understanding. Yeah, that's the only way.
It's the only way. So if we increase our understanding, the attachments sort of fall away. They just fall away without any sort of direct effort to become detached as such?
The right path can lead one to more understanding of reality. If one just have a desire to have more without understanding what can eliminate desire, then desire grows because one always attached to something all the time, even to having no attachment.
I think Gabrielle's question though was that if one does develop the understanding, then the attachment naturally or automatically is eradicated, is that right?
Little by little, so very little by little.
What is the connection between the development of the understanding of the reality
at
and
moment
the lessening
of attachment? Understanding, there cannot be attachment right at that moment. But when there is no right understanding, attachment is there.
Or when there's
almost all the time.
When there's dosa, there's no attachment either at that moment. But developing dosa doesn't lead to this attachment. So just to say there's no attachment at that moment of understanding doesn't explain how...
Attachment is conditions for dosa. And one cannot see attachment as attachment when it's so subtle. But when there is dosa, it's there, even it's just irritation. It's there, one can recognize it. But at the moment of the very subtle lobha, can one understand that that is lobha?
But wouldn't we be incapable of having dosa if we weren't attached to something? Because why would you become irritated or angry unless you were attached to something?
That's right.
There's some sort of
attachment always behind it.
Yeah, it would have to be, wouldn't it, with anger and irritation.
I think Kutsuchin said that a minute ago, but just coming back to the developing understanding and the eradication of attachment, there must be some other connection other than the fact that at the moment of understanding, at that moment, there's no attachment. That may be so, but is there something more that the moment of understanding conditions that helps to reduce the
attachment? Yes, because whenever there is attachment or aversion, there must be moha, ignorance. And understanding eliminates ignorance.
So ignorance then is the root cause
of
the attachment and the aversion.
Right.
But in our efforts to decrease our ignorance, wouldn't there be a desire to obtain and to gain knowledge or understanding, unless maybe you're a person from... Unless maybe you're sort of on a higher level.
There already.
Already. So I mean, this is kind of, it's kind of like
catch 22.
Right, it's a catch 22, isn't it? Because for people who have a desire to eliminate their ignorance, maybe people who are not already on a level of after reincarnations or what have you, they're obliged to have attachments, to have desires in order to decrease their ignorance.
There can be desire, and desire is there. But right understanding is not the attachment or desire. There is desire at this moment to understand this or that.
Yes.
Or just the, not desire, but the intention which is wholesome. So this is the very close, yes, between unwholesomeness and wholesomeness. Because when one desires to be good, at that moment, it's not good yet. But it's only just wanting to be. But at moment when one is kind, one does not have to think that I want to be. So at that moment of being kind, that is kusala. And that moment of wanting to be, that is akusala, unwholesome.
So one can see there's a parallel. For example, one can want to do more good, but there may not be the opportunity to do so. But from time to time, if there is the opportunity, one can show the kindness or whatever, even though one has a lot of attachment to the idea of developing more of that kind of quality.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that the wholesome quality can never manifest, otherwise there'd be no hope for anyone, because we all have so much ignorance and attachment, we would never be able to get off the merry-go-round.
Right.
So if you take that view, then you just say, oh, what's the point in trying? But obviously what Kunsichin is saying is that despite all the unwholesomeness and ignorance we have, that if one understands the value of the moment of right understanding or wholesomeness, then that understanding can be a condition for a very low level of wholesomeness.
Mm-hmm.
At times, you know, when there is no attachment or illusion or ignorance, if the opportunity is there, and I guess one builds on these.
Mm-hmm. So for instance, when we talked about the desire to be a good person or to do
mm-hmm.
good things,
yeah.
During the moments that there is this desire to be a good person, this is unwholesome.
Right.
But if the opportunity arises to perform
wholesome.
An act, then it's wholesome.
Mm-hmm.
But what if we took two people, one person who has not thought about his desire to
mm-hmm.
be a good person,
yeah.
and another person who has thought
yes.
about it,
mm-hmm.
who has been unwholesome
mm-hmm.
in this desire to be a good
yeah.
person, and we have an accident in front of these two people,
mm-hmm.
and they both run to help
mm-hmm.
this person.
Yeah.
This person never thought about
right.
it. So his act
is
pure.
Right.
This person also, when he's actually
yes.
performing the
right.
act, doing a kind,
just at that action.
Only at that
yeah.
moment.
Yeah. But the desire is there, see. So one can see that desire can be desire for good things or goodness or wholesomeness
mm-hmm.
as well. But it's still desire. Desire is always desire.
But when you say the desire is there, it's not there at the moment of the impulsive
right.
response
mm-hmm.
and helping.
But before that.
I think it is there in a sense, because I think for some people there may be some sort of gratification, even in that split second
different moments
where you react.
Yeah.
No, it depends on whether that action is wholesome
mm-hmm.
and it's done by wholesome moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just wanting to be wholesome at that very moment.
Right.
But even in that act, we can say there are different moments. For example, like in that movie we watched, The Hero, where the guy who's a total rat bag, but actually there's an aeroplane crash and he rescues the people. Well, there are different moments. Moments of not thinking of himself, really trying to help other people, but moments of
worrying about getting his shoes dirty.
And moments
yeah.
of hoping to get a pat on the
mm-hmm.
back,
yeah.
and moments
stealing
of
the
right,
belongings.
He's
mm-hmm.
rescuing this woman, but
yeah.
putting her money in his pocket. So,
yeah.
And in the same
mm-hmm.
way, you can say before that act, when someone has the desire to be a good person, you can't say it's all wholesome, it's all unwholesome. Of course, most moments in a day are unwholesome,
mm-hmm.
akusala. But there can be moments of just wanting to be a nice, kind person, not wanting to be an angry person. We know it's all desire and attachment, but there may be moments in between that attachment of just for a moment seeing the value of...
That is not desire.
That's a moment of...
Because seeing the value...
Is understanding for a moment, so that moment is not desire.
Right.
So it's not like it's all black or it's all white,
right.
but a stretch in many, many different moments. So in the good act, the moments of unwholesomeness, and in the desire, moments of unwholesomeness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's only the understanding that can know the difference between the different moments. But actually, the more understanding grows, the more it sees that a lot of what we thought were good or wholesome moments, you know, are just attachments. But it doesn't
mean
that
if one does something helpful, you know, in a calculated way, doesn't mean it's totally void of wholesomeness,
right.
actually.
Mm-hmm.
Just like when someone says, oh, I was depressed all day yesterday, or angry with my husband all day yesterday. Well, of course, no one's angry or depressed for a whole day,
mm-hmm.
not even for a whole 5 minutes. Even in the anger, there could be lots of moments of attachment, there could be moments of realizing this is so destructive and unwholesomeness. So it's never...
Right.
continuous.
No, different moments.
That's true, because it comes back down to thinking only a moment, because there wouldn't be a continuum of moments that are also similar.
No, and we can't know for someone else. You see someone risking those people up the aeroplane or whatever, and it all looks like in the film, oh, such a hero, such a wonderful person, mm-hmm. but only the person can know for themselves right. what the different...
What each moment contained.
Or, mm-hmm. yes, what the real intentions were.
So we could distinguish between, as you said before, intention, an intention to do something and a desire to do something,
right.
as far as gaining knowledge mm-hmm. or decreasing our ignorance.
Yeah. Because you see that when we talk about reality, like intention is not attachment.
Mm-hmm.
And for intention, there can be wholesome intention and unwholesome intention.
Mm-hmm.
But for desire or attachment, it cannot be wholesome at all.
Right.
Even its object is desire for something which is good. But the desire itself is unwholesome.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that moment, one is not calm or free from akusala, unwholesomeness.
Mm-hmm.
But when akusala moments arise, we are not worried about wanting to be this or that, because it's there already, mm-hmm. wholesome reality.
We were talking earlier about families ordaining their sons into the monkhood mm-hmm. or pansa.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another example of there might be desire for a particular result there. There might be a lot of wrong view about what can result from such an act. There might be some appreciation of wholesome things connected with the practice of, you know, of keeping the teachings alive or introducing the teachings to the person being ordained
mm-hmm.
or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Very mixed motives.
Right, intentions. Motives, that's actually what motivates all of these acts that people do to gain merit. And I think if you break it down to an individual level, it would be different than if you look at it in society, because in society many large factors will motivate, especially for initiating sons into the monkhood, I think. There are social motivations and merit gaining and symbolic motivations that may have nothing to do with that one person's motivation. I think probably nowadays, if we look at these young monks who are going to the monkhood, their motivation is not, maybe I hope that I'm wrong, but it is probably not to renounce his household and not to renounce his material existence. It's probably more motivated by a symbolic factor or a social factor.
Tradition.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny because Buddha didn't want any sort of tradition to follow himself,
mm-hmm.
but people had such a need, such a desire to have icons and to have traditions and to have things to worship and to have rituals, and that's everything he was against. And that's why I find Buddhism interesting but contradictory sometimes.
Buddhism itself is interesting because it helps one to understand realities. But the understanding of those Buddhists who think that they understand the teachings, but they misunderstand the teaching because they do not study the teaching at all. They just follow the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the teacher says, they believe. That's all. They do not really study the teaching.
So I suppose they could. Tradition in itself is not necessarily one huge conglomeration of attachments. It could be, people could participate in the traditions and even in the rituals if they had a right understanding without being attached to
them. Because you see that we think of the story of someone is being ordained on the family of that person. But that is only object of consciousness which thinks about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on this small world, not the big whole world like that, to be understood of that very moment whether the consciousness of the citta is wholesome or unwholesome.
Mm-hmm.
It's only the story or the subject or object of thinking. And we cannot tell the other's citta, consciousness. Impossible. Because even at this moment of seeing, it's only this world, this small world, which experience an object and think, and hear and think everything after experiencing through the sense door, the mind door follows and think up the idea of story and people and things.
So provided there's nothing, you know, inherently unwholesome in a particular traditional ritual, you know, sacrifice or whatever, the people who participate in it may have widely different motives or intentions for doing so, and also at the time of doing so. As Ajahn Sitchin says, you cannot tell from the act of participating just what their intentions are at that time. Some could do it with detachment, some could do it with appreciation of the wholesome aspects of it, and some could do it just out of ignorance and wrong view, prejudice.
For me, I just go. Just go. No idea. Right. No appreciation.
Just go along.
Yeah, just go along.
Just teal.
Because if I was invited and then I think that I have time, okay, going there, like going to somewhere.
Going to the movies.
But
I think the Buddha at one time said that for lay people or for family members, something about following the traditions and
what
rituals.
What kind of traditions?
Well, I suppose traditions such as respecting one's ancestors.
It can be the development of Kusala.
It can be development of Kusala.
Depending on how do you teach the children.
Yes. But I think he makes the point that just because there are other people doing it for whom there is no understanding of the wholesome aspect, who are doing it purely from wrong motives,
more or less.
It doesn't mean that one has to shy away from it. And
But he didn't say anything about the wrong tradition or...
No, he didn't. He didn't say
this. If the tradition is wrong, can one follow?
Sacrifice, for example, is wrong. So
he did say it was inherently... There are some things which are inherently unwholesome.
I don't think he said that. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, that nothing, so we could say that people who spend their entire lives doing nothing but accumulating money in this modern world here in Bangkok, many people exist simply to gain more money in their lives, and maybe, I don't know if they're detached or not, we can never say. But would we say that there cannot be inherently anything unwholesome in that? It just depends on their attachment to those things?
Some people are born into wealth, for example. So the fact they have wealth isn't a reflection on them in any sense whatsoever. And for some people it falls into their lap, you know, without doing much. And some people can be very, very greedy and really ambitious, but not succeed in gaining any wealth in a lifetime. There are so many factors involved. But to see someone who devote their life to making money, again, one just can't say what, because from the outer appearance, one doesn't know what the moment to moment. I mean, the person could make money and give it away at the same time.
Well, I can say for sure most of their life is full of desire or attachment, but then most of everyone's life is so it's
different kinds. Family, attachment to family.
Right.
What's the difference between attachment to family and attachment to money?
That's right.
It's just attachment.
Or attachment to lying on the beach, or attachment to
some of the biggest benefactors in Hong Kong, and I'm sure it's the same here, are the millionaires. They give away tens of millions of dollars to the public benefit. endowing universities or whatever.
In the Buddha's time, some of his chief lay disciples were very wealthy people, kings and
merchants.
Some were poor beggars and some were rich kings. I don't know that one could.
Yeah, I think
making any judgment by the outer appearance is risky, isn't it?
Right. And I didn't need to make a judgment because I'm not in any position to judge anything. But the problem that I guess because I'm currently reading about merit making merit in especially in Thai society, and basically 10 baht makes more merit than 1 baht. And so that I have a problem with this. I don't know if it's just in Thai culture that this Buddhism developed specifically this way, or what the Buddha said about it. Because
what do you mean 10 baht?
Basically, baht.
Baht.
More money. If you donate more money,
the more money, the more merit.
The more money, the more merit.
Right. Which of course can't be right because it has to be the intention, right? 10 baht for one person is the equivalent of 1 baht for another person.
Right. I don't know if it can put a quality on that, or if it's only in the sort
you couldn't
of
the count the merit by
but
the.
But usually I don't read those books because I have time for Tipitaka or the teachings. Because I think that people just write anything they think that it's right for.
That has nothing to do with the Buddhist teachings.
No, but sometimes the book reflects popular belief.
Yes,
and to that extent.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. So that's what you're interested in. Yeah. So she's interested in how Thai society thinks and feels.
Well, I'm interested to see the difference between what happens in society and what happens really with the Dharma and with Buddhism.
I think that it's not only Thailand, Japan, and everywhere.
Any country.
Those who do not study think that they understand the teaching. So they write or they do anything that they think that it is Buddhist or Buddhist way of life.
Ask a Christian what he thinks about the groups in the Philippines that nail themselves to the cross at Easter and all this sort of thing. I mean, you can't say that reflects on Christianity because these are people who are superstitious and just.
I guess that kind of takes the difference between Buddhism as a religion. People who see it as a religion and people who don't, who see it as their philosophy for life, for their own.
Well, even among the latter, there can be on view and practice. Look at all the people who go off and who sit and meditate for hours and hours in the belief that they're going to have a flash of enlightenment.
Look at all the followers of that Japanese cult leader. He studied Buddhism and he met the Dalai Lama, a yogi and whatever. The
distinction, I think, is between the teaching and the understanding of what's been taught. There's really no point in studying the latter. I'm talking now in an absolute sense. I mean, there's a point, from a conventional academic viewpoint. But for us who are interested in the teaching, there's absolutely nothing of interest in that sense in how the teachings are understood by the people.
Another good example would be, like when people go to temples and worship in front of the Buddha statue. Well, for most people now in Thai culture, they think that they are praying to Buddha to help them and bring them a happy, prosperous life and a few more lives afterwards. The point is to just reflect on the qualities of the Buddha that can help us today in our life, but there's no being or person there. So any simple act can be so many different interpretations. But I think it's when you realize that in any society, we're all here because of ignorance, like most people's lives, guided by ignorance. Of course, most deeds go to the Dhamma influence. But basically, these deeds could be done from any range of intentions. So people could go and sit in front of a Buddha statue and do all the same ritual behavior, but with
understanding. But one has to have heard and considered what is useful and what is right. If one's never heard what is useful and right, then one cannot, if one performs those actions, one's going to have a wrong misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. So if one's never heard that the value of paying respects to the Buddha is to consider the qualities of the Buddha that were developed and which can help us today, for example, then if one's never heard of this idea, mm-hmm. then
it's impossible.
Exactly.
When I hear this discussion, it reminds me of in India, when one goes to the holy places, you know, the place of the Buddha's enlightenment, for example, and one sees a lot of Tibetans for whom the understanding is that prostration is very meritorious.
Mm-hmm.
And they will cover vast distances by prostrating a full length on the ground, getting up and taking one step forward. I just feel really, I suppose it's kusala, I feel really sorry for them, because it's all motivated by one view.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of accumulating merit, they're accumulating demerit.
Well, I feel less sorry for them than when I see groups of people just sort of sitting for hours praying to Buddha in Thailand or Sri Lanka, because at least the Tibetans are getting some exercise while they do it.
They're always looking around at what's going on and they do another prostration.
Can there be a so very short moment, which is wholesome with upright understanding? Very short moment.
Yes.
Which is wholesome with outright understanding.
With a short moment mm-hmm. of wholesome with outright
yes,
understanding.
Yes,
yes.
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 Mm-hmm.
The impulsive response to someone's need. Impulsive assistance.
So it's very difficult to tell the other's consciousness or mind thoughts. And if one does not study the teachings, can one say that one knows Buddhism?
No. One can know Buddhism as a social fact,
but it's not
the same. No, that's
that is not the teachings of Buddha at all.
No, not by any means. That's my point, is that it's very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at the two, they're very, very different. They have nothing to do with one another.
So when we study, we ignore those who do not study because they just believe that they are Buddhists, but they don't know anything about the teachings
mm-hmm.
at all. Even becoming a monk, they just want to be a monk or want their son to be ordained
mm-hmm.
without understanding the teachings.
There's no understanding whatsoever.
Just want to follow
the teaching. Understanding the purpose of becoming, leading a monk's life.
Mm-hmm. For me, the monk's life is the arahata's life.
You familiar with the term arahata?
Arahata, arahant, the one.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Enlightened one.
Mm-hmm.
The one who doesn't have any defilements at all.
Okay.
Completely eradicated all kinds of akusala and
wholesomeness. Mm-hmm. When you say, the monk's life for you is the arahat's life, but of course, in the Buddha's time,
for those
the
who really,
were not arahats.
For those who really want to reach that goal, becoming an arahata, because one can become enlightened any time, any moment, without being a monk.
But what about those before you used to say to lead the monks like this, for those who know that this is the suitable way of living?
It's very difficult
mm-hmm.
life for those who still have attachment. So it's the life of arahata.
But many people, many monks in the Buddha's time were not arahats.
But they knew, or Buddha pointed out, that monks who follow the Vinaya disciplines are like an arahata, because monks' life is arahata's life, the way they live in daily life. Anyone is not, it's not necessary for anyone to become a monk, to become enlightened. That's why for Buddhists there are lay people too, not only monks.
Who become enlightened?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to meditation, do any of you practice? Because I don't think, I have the feeling that this is, that Alan and Ivan and so forth are very much against it. But wouldn't it be, isn't it supposedly just a way to stop your mind from going to stop and get into, to sort of practice stopping your time and getting into a moment? So isn't there something to be said for it, or it can be sort of done just without performing the actual positions? Is that what?
Yeah, but what is the goal or the object of doing so?
Of doing a meditation?
Yes, what is the objective?
I would think that it would be to stop your mind.
Why do you want to stop your mind?
So that you can have a consciousness of a moment.
There is consciousness now. You cannot do anything. You cannot stop the arising of any consciousness now.
Mm-hmm. But having consciousness, you mean understand a moment.
Mm-hmm.
He means that you can understand
a moment,
being aware of a moment
better,
stop your mind.
If you can sort of train your mind to slow down and
you can you slow down your mind? In reality?
No, I haven't succeeded.
Is it possible for anyone to slow down their mind?
Well, personally I've never been capable, and that's why I've never been sort of into meditation, but I had the feeling that other people were capable of slowing down their thought processes so that they could be aware of the moment.
And they suddenly claim that they are.
They do, and that's what, this is where I had a problem with it.
So ask them what is the mind, so that we know whether it can be slowed down or not.
Right.
Yeah, first of all, what is the mind?
They would talk about...
But they cannot slow down their thoughts either.
The problem with it is that when you say, well, you know, the idea is that one can be able to slow down one's mind and that one can then be conscious of these moments and mm-hmm. this and that, it all suggests the idea of someone or a person who can control or do this or do that. And we go through life thinking we can mm-hmm. control it, whereas in reality, the heart of Buddhism, what distinguishes it from other philosophies is that there isn't mm-hmm. someone, there isn't a self who can mm-hmm. control what appears at this moment, whether it's attachment or aversion or any of the other realities we've been talking about. It happens like that because mm-hmm. it's conditioned that way.
Mm-hmm.
But where is the someone to stop it or change it or control it or make it faster or slower? So it's like people think they are interested in Buddhism mm-hmm. or that they are Buddhists,
mm-hmm.
but they still want to be able to control. It's like
That's
not
right.
enough confidence in actually understanding the reality at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And also beneath it is this strong desire to change the reality that's conditions.
Right.
So they meditate because they want to have less aversion
mm-hmm.
in their life. No one wants to get angry, so they think they can change it or control it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not detachment. The development of detachment means accepting and being detached mm-hmm. from the reality that is
condition now anyway,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a good one or a bad one, or we like it or don't like,
mm-hmm.
instead of always trying to change it
mm-hmm.
for another one.
Right.
So this is why we are more interested in understanding our lives as they are at this moment,
right.
rather than trying to change it for a different one, because we know that that trying to change it or trying to control it is ignorance.
Right. And I suppose anyway, if what they are trying to do is slow down the mind, if there is such an entity as such, the only thing that could slow it down would be the mind anyway, who is actually working to slow it down, so it's not really slowing down, is it? Do you see what I mean? The mind is, it's working anyway, it's not really slowing down. It's working on trying to slow it down, so it's...
The mind is going to do what it's going to do anyway, and I don't know that it's because the cheetahs, the moments of consciousness, follow each other so rapidly. So, if one has the idea, suddenly there are fewer moments of consciousness in this hour, it sounds like some delusion. Okay, maybe there are fewer moments of getting angry, but what about all the moments of ignorance? What about the moments of hearing, or the moments of pleasant feeling, or what is the point of having it slower, or... Again, it's just not accepting what is appearing, but I don't believe it can be, even by itself, that it can slow down, because those moments of consciousness follow each other so rapidly, and I think the more understanding grows, the more one realizes.
But if you don't know at all and you just want to slow down the mind, it's just follow, like the blind follow the blind.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not satisfied with anything that I cannot understand. Just follow. If they say that they can slow down the mind, they should tell me first what the mind is. Not just, let's slow down the mind.
What do you understand by the mind? Well, this is... I couldn't define it if I had to. I couldn't. I mean, I would say probably just to begin with, the tip of the iceberg would be the thoughts and the thought process, but that would only be the tip of the iceberg. I couldn't. You know, I certainly couldn't give a definition to mind. Could you?
What a lot of people also say is they say, okay, well, so then they slow down their actions too. They say, okay, well, they want to be aware of drinking their water, so they kind of drink the water in slow motion so that they can be aware of the water and the sensation.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, you know, what is the actual reality? The reality is not the glass of water that one's picking up and drinking. The reality is thinking, as you say, thinking, seeing,
mm-hmm.
attachment, aversion, temperature, hot, heat, cold, these are different realities. But a lot of people, when they're interested in meditation or slowing down, they just talk about or being aware of the mind or being aware of their actions.
Mm-hmm.
But these are just concepts. We talk about the mind, it's just an idea, it's
That's
just
right.
a concept.
It's just another thought.
It's just another thought, exactly. Mm-hmm. So if there isn't any understanding of what the actual realities are, how can there be development of any awareness, fast or slow or any other speed? So in fact, one doesn't have to do it in slow motion because there are already moments of seeing light or cold or heat.
Mm-hmm.
How about just being aware of the realities that appear?
They're trying to force some particular ones, which just concepts, just stories that we have. I think it also depends on, one has to be clear about one's aim. What about the idea behind it?
So the question is, doesn't one want to develop understanding of reality of this moment? Or does one want to escape, go away from understanding reality of this moment and do something that one doesn't know?
Mm-hmm.
The real aim, whether what one is trying to achieve, like wanting to, what you say,
stop, slow down the mind,
and stop something.
No,
just
slow down the mind so that one can experience the mind better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Experience a moment, have more access to each individual moment to become aware of
it. So Kun Su Chin is just saying that that means one is turning away from knowing this moment,
mm-hmm.
because one is saying, what I want to know is such and such,
mm-hmm.
which is other than this moment.
Right.
And before mm-hmm. I can do that, I need to do X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. it means one doesn't want to know
sort
this
of taking
moment.
The long way around, isn't
taking
it?
The long way around.
But what people say is, oh, well, what you say is quite right, but it's too difficult for beginners. So for beginners, we try to help them by slowing down or concentrating on certain sensations so that when they get to know that, well, then they can come back and talk to you and develop understanding of other realities.
I think it's one of the great revelations of understanding Dhamma, that what one is being urged to understand is only this moment, this ordinary, everyday, mundane moment. Another thing about the meditators, of course, is that they want to put aside all unwholesomeness
mm-hmm.
for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
One isn't being told just to understand
mm-hmm.
wholesomeness. What the Dhamma teaches really is to understand unwholesomeness and to see one's unwholesomeness as well as, of course, wholesomeness. But if one thinks that one has to have a completely still mind, you know, before one can see that moment, then of course one isn't as willing to see all the...
There's the unwholesomeness. The
unwholesomeness.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, it's just this very ordinary, mundane moment that is to be studied and known.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's a particular reality. Because, of course, this ordinary moment, as we perceive it, is an agglomeration of different realities that are put together to create the world that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've talked before about seeing an invisible object and hearing and sound.
Mm-hmm.
So one has to understand that these are the component parts of the present moment, and it's understanding these realities that is the goal. If one understands that, then why deny that they arise, they exist in this moment?
I guess it is sort of a false, I'm thinking in French, it's sort of a false experience. It's like it has nothing to do with reality.
No. I mean, it's just like if you go and have a lovely walk in a quiet forest and feel very peaceful, and then you come and are hit by the traffic. It's just the same thing. It's just attachment. It's so pleasant, and the feelings are so lovely. It's just attachment, and
mm-hmm.
one's always sorry when one loses the objects of one's attachment.
And yet there's another question. Would you like to see, or would you like to understand? When one meditates, one wants to see, to experience something, right? Not talking about understanding anything at all.
Some people meditate to have a particular experience,
mm-hmm.
which is what I think the judges mean by seeing.
We have to float or to have some
yes.
experience.
Mm-hmm.
Or even physiological reactions.
Yes. So, you can choose whether you'd like to understand reality or just want to experience something strange.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very strange, because it's not the common one, like
mm-hmm.
now. So when we talk about meditation, I think that we use the term that one would do something different from developing understanding of this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are many meditation centers with many methods, not developing understanding
mm-hmm.
naturally, normally.
So, but it cannot be, understanding cannot be developed unnaturally, it cannot be developed in any other way. So it's not, it cannot develop understanding if it's not natural.
Right. Because when there is no understanding of this moment or reality now, how can there be understanding of something which is not now?
Mm-hmm.
And right understanding performs the function of being detached little by little, depending on the degrees of understanding. But wanting to do something doesn't bring to detachment at all, because you want to get, you want to have something, to experience something, not to understand reality and become detached from not understanding it.
You said become detached from not understanding.
Because when there is attachment, there is ignorance, not understanding it, so there is attachment because there is ignorance. But when there is understanding, even from hearing, reading, considering, it's the way to become detached from not knowing about realities while one does not learn or study or read or discuss.
I'm a tiny bit confused.
If one does not study,
mm-hmm.
one has ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
So how can there be detachment from ignorance?
Right, there cannot be, there cannot be detachment mm-hmm. from ignorance. It's with understanding that we become detached.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot go the other way, and we cannot detach unless
understanding.
Okay.
Understanding and detachment together.
Okay, but it has to go through understanding to become
only
detached.
Way. Mm-hmm.
Okay, when I heard detached from not knowing, it confused me, because I thought that can't be possible. Okay. We cannot be detached from ignorance.
That's another way of saying understanding.
Right.
It's detachment from ignorance.
Mm-hmm. But in the moment of detachment from ignorance, there's understanding.
If understanding itself.
At the moment of understanding,
that
there
isn't
is
understanding.
Detachment
yeah.
from ignorance.
Right. But it doesn't dissolve the ignorance, it just detaches from it, but it's another form of understanding.
You could say at that moment, for that moment, when there is understanding,
mm-hmm.
there is no ignorance for that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then next moment, no understanding.
Ignorance is dispelled for that moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in fact you could say there's ignorance at every moment that there isn't understanding.
Mm-hmm.
That's why there should be the development of understanding in order to eradicate ignorance and attachment to it. In meditation, at the meditation center, doesn't help one to understand reality of this moment. So there is no way to eradicate attachment and aversion and ignorance from life.
Mm-hmm. So this would only be by studying Dhamma, by studying the Dhamma, that one could. Does one necessarily have to study the Dhamma to gain understanding?
Without studying, I don't think that anyone can gain
mm-hmm.
any understanding.
Mm-hmm. One cannot be detached.
One has to hear the Dhamma, because one would never come to understand this by oneself,
mm-hmm.
because there's too much ignorance and misunderstanding to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So one has to hear it. Some people need to hear it a lot, and
mm-hmm.
study a lot before any of it makes any sense. And others, of course, could hear it once and it would be almost a revelation.
Mm-hmm.
The understanding of realities as not self,
mm-hmm.
unless one has heard something about not self and about realities, that kind of understanding
mm-hmm.
cannot develop.
Mm-hmm.
It's good, it's wholesome if people are encouraged to give or encouraged to abstain from killing or encouraged to be helpful, it's good, it's wholesome. But the highest level or the highest kind of wholesomeness is the development of understanding, which knows that it's not self who performs these other deeds.
We distinguish what is the difference or the line that we draw between something that is human nature, something that, is there anything that is human nature? Because when we talk about understanding as far as giving or not killing, some people may argue that this is just, this is innate, this is not something that is developed with understanding, it's just a natural fact.
Well, you could say that we all have different tendencies. You can say, oh, well, it's human nature to be greedy or attached or to live in ignorance, but some people, by their natural tendency, you know, you can see some small children are much more inclined to share their toys than others, so some people are naturally more generous or kinder than others. But you can also say that that's why it's important to hear and know what is wholesome and what isn't, because someone can be naturally very kind and generous. If all their friends say, oh, you're crazy, you're always giving money to beggars, but then they just go and drink and you really should stop, then they may change their habit and become less generous. Mm-hmm. One of our friends says that she's naturally rather stingy. She finds it difficult to give or difficult to share, but if one actually hears about the value, one may begin to be more generous or one may begin to help more. Those tendencies can develop and can change.
You call it about human nature, but there are more teachings about understanding this human nature.
That's
right. You just call it human nature, but what is the reality of the human nature? Like mine, we use many terms, many words about the things that we do not really understand yet until we come to consider and understand these different characteristics.
It's a bit like an example we were giving earlier about the plane crash or doing something good. In fact, there are so many different moments and different intentions. Well, same in human nature. One may say, oh, my son A is a very generous and my son B is very stingy. But one can see, oh, moments of generosity, moments of stinginess, moments of jealousy, different moments, different realities. So you can't say, well, A is this or B is that, or, oh, well, it's human nature to be this.
Right. So there is no human nature.
Well, this is why what Kunzichen is saying, if we just talk about human nature, it's very general and vague. What do we mean? What do you mean by human nature?
You can define any concept you like and then use the term.
Are there realities? Kindness? Stinginess? Are there realities? Are they real? Or just word or concept? The nature of kindness, the nature of stinginess, are these things real or are they only concepts?
They'd be concepts, yeah.
No reality at all, or?
Maybe in the moment that one is being stingy or being kind, but it comes down to the moment, doesn't it?
Kindness itself, is it real? Or it's just idea or concept of kindness?
I suppose as we're talking about it now, it would just be a concept.
But...
yeah, what she's saying is that the moment of kindness, it's real.
That's when it becomes real.
But if we're just talking about it without there being any kindness concept at that moment.
But can only be real in the moment that it's being done or being experienced.
Yeah. So it's real, right?
It is real.
At that moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We can talk about that reality at other moments, and we use the term kindness to as a label for that reality.
So it is real in the moment that it's being experienced.
Is it you or someone? Kindness itself. Does it belong to anyone? We know that it's real,
mm-hmm.
And is it someone, or you, or me? Kindness?
No.
No. So it's just a reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which arises by conditions. Right conditions for its arising just at very moment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a reality. So in one's life, there are different realities arising by conditions. Without conditions, nothing can arise.
Mm-hmm.
Aversion is a reality. Attachment is a reality. Stinginess is a reality. So there are many different realities which do not belong to anyone. They are different realities by themselves, by their conditions of arising. We just call him Jonathan and him Sarah, but in reality, different realities from moment to moment. Is seeing a reality? Seeing now sees. Is it a reality?
So.
Ask another question. Is sound a reality?
No.
Yes or no?
No.
Do we hear sound?
The sound, hearing is what we think is real, isn't it? And seeing is what we think is real.
Well, I suppose it's different for everyone, but getting back to seeing, I have difficulty with seeing being real, although it's not so difficult for me to accept that visible object is real. What is seen that not these objects but light in any way?
Mm-hmm.
Hearing and sound, maybe it's easier to understand that hearing is real,
mm-hmm.
but hearing has to hear something. What hearing hears is sound.
Mm-hmm.
Sound is experienced by hearing.
Hearing. But where does the reality lie then? Which is real and which isn't real?
Well, can they not both be real? But different kinds of realities.
Because I would say that seeing and hearing are realities experienced by...
Not you.
By me.
No, I would say that what I experience as far as seeing goes is... The seeing part is the only thing that I could say is real.
Okay.
What is seen and the sound...
One can talk about experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one experiences, say, that's through the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
One experiences a certain object.
Right, or a sound by the hearing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I could only say that something which is an object which is seen or a sound which is heard, I could only say or attempt to say that it's real because of the experience of seeing or hearing.
Yeah, well, you could say that if there was no seeing, there could be no object that was seen,
mm-hmm.
if there was no hearing. But okay, how about if you block your ears,
mm-hmm.
and then you release it, and immediately there is some sound, whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
and then a minute later you think, oh, what's that sound? It's the dishes in the kitchen and the AC. But that moment of releasing, what is heard,
mm-hmm.
is real.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone starts thinking about it, of course, it's concepts. And the same, as soon as one takes away one's hands, what is experienced by the
mm-hmm.
seeing, we can call it the object of seeing,
mm-hmm.
and it's real at that moment,
mm-hmm.
and then thinking and ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is seeing, there must be something that is seen. If there's hearing, it must be something that's heard, that experience, that seeing, and what is seen, whatever we want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
The combination is what we think of as, oh, I can see, or
mm-hmm.
seeing, but that really it's just the experiencing of seeing and what is seen, and this is what we think of as self or somewhere.
Mm-hmm. So where's the reality? The reality is in the totality of the experience?
The reality is what is actually experiencing and what is experienced at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe forget about the word reality if it's confusing. So without giving any names or labels,
mm-hmm.
the experiencing through the eyes,
mm-hmm.
it's happening, it's real.
Mm-hmm.
What is seen is real.
Mm-hmm.
But if we put immediately afterwards we're thinking of TV and AC and
mm-hmm.
food in the kitchen, so
mm-hmm.
then thinking always thinks about gossips and stories.
Mm-hmm.
But if there wasn't anything seen, thinking wouldn't think about anything
mm-hmm.
to do with.
In fact, it's rather the reverse. The totality of the experience is the unreal.
Story,
it's the unreal part
mm-hmm.
of it. It's the story that is made up from the
moments of experience.
Different moments of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why the world as we know it is unreal
mm-hmm.
in absolute terms. And there are, in fact, you could say, these different worlds. The seeing and the hearing and the other sense experiences and the thinking
mm-hmm.
that make up this one world in the conventional sense. Because without seeing, without hearing, and without thinking about what is seen and heard, what would there be?
Now we are getting to understand the absolute truth or absolute reality. That we don't need to use any word at all, but we use to represent realities, like seeing. Even we don't call it seeing, it sees now. It has its function of seeing, which is experiencing visible object only. Seeing cannot hear, so hearing is another reality, absolute reality, that we don't have to call it hearing. In English or Dayin in Thai or other language, because hearing is real. It is the moment of experiencing sound only.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about absolute realities, in reality we don't have to call it anything because it has its own characteristic and its own function. Like mind, when we talk about mind, and we don't know the absolute reality of that reality that we use the word mind.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't really understand what mind is if we don't talk about the absolute reality. So when we talk about the experiencing, because when one was born, it's not only body, but there must be that reality which experiences an object from birth to death, changing from one moment to another moment, or one moment of experiencing an object and it falls away after performing the function of experiencing its object, like seeing whenever it arises, yesterday, today, tomorrow, or 20 years ahead, it sees, it just can see, it's that element which can experience visible object. And it's not me, it's not anyone, because it's conditioned by eye sense
mm-hmm.
and visible object and other conditions for its arising. Not just one or two factors or conditions, there are more. So in a moment, many realities are conditioned to arise and perform their functions, like seeing is that faculty of experiencing an object. But at moment of experiencing or seeing, there must be feeling too. And what kind of feeling is there when there is seeing? Just that very moment of seeing, the feeling is indifferent feeling. It cannot be pleasant or unpleasant yet, because it's just that flash of seeing no thinking about the object which is seen. And this is the absolute reality of a moment, moving from one moment to another moment, from day to night, from time to time. And we call these processes someone or being. Can be man or woman or animal, cat and dog. Seeing is seeing, hearing is hearing, thinking is thinking. And what is mine then? So I think that if we use the same word, it is not clear. But if we use new word like citta, one can understand better, because it's that reality which experiences an object through the five sense and the mind, or without these five senses, it still can think about sorry and things, and that is another sense. I don't know whether you call it sixth sense or not. No? Sixth sense?
The mind? I think we just can talk about five senses and the mind.
And the mind. So while one is sitting, talking, thinking, there are two different realities, the mental realities and the corporeality or physical reality. In Pali it's nama for the experiencing, and the rupa for the reality which cannot experience anything at all. And there are many types of nama and many types of rupa that can be known right now, that can be directly experienced. It's rising and falling away even right now. But it has to be developed by right understanding from hearing and considering and being aware of our reality from moment to moment.
Mm-hmm. So feeling, a feeling of regret or a feeling...
There are five kinds of feelings. Pleasant feeling, bodily, mentally, unpleasant feeling, bodily, mentally, and indifferent feeling.
Conventionally, we talk about feeling to include other things. So let's say regret.
The experience of regret, yes. Mm-hmm.
So
is it pleasant at that moment when you feel regret? Is it pleasant?
No.
So it's unpleasant feeling.
Mm-hmm. But these feelings, if each moment is made up of an experience, experiencing a visual object or experiencing a sound or something, is the feeling what later results?
Not later, arising together. Mm-hmm. So there are four kinds of absolute realities.
Mm-hmm.
Citta, the faculty of experiencing an object, and cetasika, mental factor, which arises with citta. Whenever a moment of citta arises, there are many mental factors arising together, like feeling, for example,
mm-hmm.
and memory, and intention.
Mm-hmm.
You might not know that there is intention at that moment, but it's there because it has to perform its function to with each citta's arising. And rupa, the reality which cannot experience anything. And the last one is nibbana, the reality which is not citta, cetasika, and rupa. So there are only four kinds of absolute realities. So in daily life there are only three kinds, citta, cetasika arising together, and rupa too, but rupa cannot experience anything, like softness.
When Ajahn, since there are only three kinds of realities, I mean, of course, what she's saying is that all the realities that we experience can be classified as one of three. three kinds. Although there are other ways of classifying realities which will give you a different number.
Of course not.
Three categories of absolute reality.
Different ways of categorizing and bundling them to help us to understand them better.
So now there are only absolute realities, but there is no understanding them as absolute realities, because we used to think of story, concept about realities. For example, we think that I see many things in this room, but in reality, seeing sees and thinking thinks.
And feeling.
Feels.
Feels.
Pleasant and pleasant, bodily, mentally, indifferent.
Yes. So we can have pleasant, unpleasant, or indifferent feelings which just arise, but they don't necessarily indicate an attachment.
Attachment can arise with pleasant or indifferent feeling. There are two kinds of feeling that can accompany attachment or arise with attachment. The indifferent feeling and the pleasant feeling.
Unpleasant is not an attachment.
No, unpleasant cannot arise with attachment at all. It arises with aversion. Whenever it arises, it has to arise with aversion. That's why we cannot control. We cannot do anything. Each moment is conditioned. But there can be more understanding developed by reading, considering, being aware. When we use the term absolute reality, it means that we cannot do anything. We cannot change. But we can understand, developing understanding. Because understanding itself is not I. It's different from attachment. But it's a reality, wholesome reality.
I still see unpleasant feelings as a form of attachment.
It's like at this moment, it seems like one sees and one hears simultaneously, right? But they are different realities.